Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Cotterman. I am the Associate Artistic Director of the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory, and we are talking about King John today, and I am joined by a whole bunch of people from King John. Let's just go around and introduce ourselves, starting to my right with Mr. Tom DeLise.
Hi, I'm Tom DeLise. I'm the director.
Hello, I'm Anne Hammontree, and I'm playing Constance.
Hello, I'm Grayson Owen, and I'm playing Louis the Dauphin.
I'm Dean Carlson. I'm playing King John.
I'm Sean Edwards, and I'm playing Pandulf the Cardinal.
I'm Zach Brewster-Geis, and I'm playing King Philip of France.
And I am also in this play, and I'm playing Philip the Bastard.
So many Philips.
Philip Falconbridge slash
Philip Richard
Plantagenet. So King John is a special play because King John's a relative of mine. It's my 23rd great-grandfather on my mom's side.
So,
so I have a close personal connection. But also, this is a play that I'm have a soft spot for just because it's never been performed in the city like in a very long time. In fact, the last production of it was 1782 by the Maryland Company of Comedians. It was the first theater company, the first full-time professional theater company established after the Revolution.
And believe it or not, the show is actually very funny.
It is.
Yeah. It's funny that comedians actually perform.
It's strange how underperformed it is. Tom, why do you think it's so like notoriously underperformed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm really not sure why, because it is a play that, you know, I think is greatly undervalued. And honestly, is from the standpoint of a history play, I think it's really one of the easiest history plays to understand. I think overall, it's got less characters. It's not built on any other plays that are like part of the War of the Roses series. So I'm not really sure. Maybe the fact that Arthur is... Not Arthur, what did I say?
John.
John is considered a villain, but I would think that would make it even more attractive.
Yeah, and in actuality, the play does present him slightly more favorably than historians of his present time period did. Okay. Yeah, and every biography that I read of John or any of the history really doesn't like this play, and it's probably because of the historical accuracy of it, but it really does present John not as a villain, but as somebody who makes bad choices.
Yeah, maybe because the two things you think of when you think of King John is probably in a modern era, you think, okay, Robin Hood and Magna Carta.
Yeah.
And neither one are in the play. So it's like, well, maybe that's why people are kind of disappointed. I mean, you know, it is the first play that we have a film of. Not the entire play, but in 1899, there was 5 clips made of King John to promote Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree's production of it in London. And only one of those 5 clips are extant. But you can go online and you can watch it. It's pretty histrionic.
It's his death scene, right?
Yeah.
A lot of leg twitching.
And bending, like, in this chair. He's just, like... totally just gyrating.
Gyrating?
Yeah. Probably not the best. But it's very physical, to say the least.
Let the record reflect that for the radio audience,
Dean actually
gyrated.
Come see King John.
See the gyration.
See the gyration.
You can hear the gyration.
So yeah, I think it, you know, like Tom said, this is it's a standalone history, unlike really any of the other ones.
Henry VIII is the only other one.
Yeah, and that was much more contemporary to Shakespeare's audience, so it had a more immediate appeal, maybe. This is the earliest of his history. No, I guess it depends on how you count Cymbeline. But this is the sort of the earliest of the Norman King histories, right? Because this is the 1100s, 1200s?
1200s.
1200s, early
right
1200s. 1200. Yeah, so this is way before Richard II. But yeah, it's I think it's a really tight play. There's not a lot of B plot action. Everything is very straightforward. I think the conflict is very straightforward. It's England versus France. That's like as basic as you get. There's no warring families, and you know I don't know why it's so.
You know, I've thought about this a lot actually, because I'm very much into like structure and stuff like that, and coming from a perspective of the sort of like the three act structure that we get from like movies, it strikes me that it's a really weird play structurally, because without spoiling too much of a hundreds of year old play that admittedly a lot of people will not have seen before they come and see this one. It seems like the conflict gets resolved at the end of Act 2 of 5, but then a whole new conflict comes in Act 3 when, England and France are all tightly knit in this marriage alliance, and then all of a sudden the Catholic Church comes in the person of Pandolf and says, hey, John, you're being a bad boy, and John says, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And then everybody else is like, oh, we got to start fighting again. So it's just really strange, like, structurally
like goes
speaking.
Goes back to the beginning. It's yeah. like, oh, yeah. no. So we had a full two acts, and we're right back where we started.
Now they're fighting for different reasons.
Exactly.
Yeah. Zach, you just mentioned something funny that it's spoiling a play that's several hundred years old, but this is a play that, like, not many people have seen.
Yeah.
Anybody in the area really has seen this, unless you've traveled to Virginia to see it, or New York, or England. So we sort of have a luxury of being able to show people something from Shakespeare that they have never seen before. And so maybe with that in mind, like, if we want to go around, and what is something that excites you about your character? Because this is the first time, Anne, that anybody in Baltimore probably will see Constance.
Yeah, she is quite the badass. She's one of the strongest female characters I've come across in Shakespeare's plays. Really strong, well-structured, put together, and she's no nonsense, and she just goes after what she wants with a fervor, and it's very refreshing. Considering, you know, how sexist some of the older plays can be. She's a very strong character and has a lot of power.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're all nodding in agreement.
Yes. We're all just nodding silently on
what do you think of that?
No, I agree. I think Constance is definitely a badass. Like, she just speaks her mind.
She really does.
Whenever she wants. And there's, like, no repercussions, because she knows that she holds the power.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She takes on, like, four incredibly powerful men in a room, and none of them really check her. None of them are like, hey, stop that. Like, she really puts them all in their place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that moment, I think, is a great one where, you know, you guys make the marriage agreement. Right? And then all of a sudden, it's almost like an afterthought, but it's like, where's Constance is here. Oh, what's she going to think about this? And everybody is like audibly.
And Grayson, you play the Dauphin.
I play the Dauphin, Louis. What I really love about Louis is he's incredibly ambitious. To a fault.
To put it mildly.
And I think he becomes this really interesting parallel to John as it kind of culminates. And coming into this play, again, not having read this before, Tom and I have kind of discussed anything after the first folio takes some lines away from Louis near the beginning of the play and gives them to the King of France. And it just gives such a disservice to, I think, the character of Louis and how Shakespeare had structured this arc that he goes on of pure ambition.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And so we kept with the first folio and kept those lines in, and it's fascinating finding all of those little through lines because of those lines that actually make Louis a more interesting character than just showing up in, like, silent for, what, all of Act 2, and then showing up in Act 5 more interested.
Yeah.
But I find Louis fascinating. Psychologically, too, I find Louis fascinating. But that's a whole other podcast.
Dean, you already touched on John a little bit, but what do you... I don't know, what's the takeaway that you want people to get from John, especially since this is something, like, you know, version of the character that they will have never seen,
yeah.
since a lot of the versions of the character come from Robin Hood.
Yeah. yeah. Well, yeah, and historians, too, that portrayed him as a very evil king, and rest assured, he does make very bad decisions. But I think the play does portray him favorably. or more favorably than any other account that I've heard of his time period. And I spoke to a professor of mine because I was kind of stumped and I was sort of like looking for something that might help me unlock a couple of things. And he had played King John before and he said, King John wants to be Richard III, but his conscience gets in the way so often. His conscience is like a worm and he wishes he could put that to the side and he could do all the politically ambitious things that, as Grayson was talking about, you know, the Dauphin just goes.
Doesn't.
And, you know, and I think he wishes he could be more ambitious, but his conscience gets in the way. So I think I'm really excited to show a King John that people don't ordinarily see or they haven't seen before. One who's a little more human, a little, like, has his faults, but you can sort of sympathize with him. That's sure. What I'm excited about, yeah.
Yeah. For those who don't know historically, not that Shakespeare really gives a damn about history. in his classic, you know, way, he mashes it together and mashes 10, 15 years together into 2 hours because he didn't really care.
No.
He was trying to tell a good story. But King John was one of the earlier of the Norman kings. And so this is right around, you know, it takes place in the early 1200s, like Tom said. You know, the Magna Carta comes out of his reign. So it's really like very early England, mm-hmm. Norman England.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an interesting time period.
and a lot of change happened in John's rule, and it lost a lot of territory that was sort of the ancestral home of many of the English barons. And,
mm-hmm.
And as a result of losing so much power, he really made a lot of mistakes to try and grab onto it and keep a hold of it.
Right, and he had followed up his brother, Richard the Lionheart,
who was
one of the great kings.
Yeah, you know, winning all these amazing battles and going on crusade, and here's John just like losing everything.
So he was in a bad spot.
Yeah.
He also inherited a bankrupt kingdom. So.
Yeah, that's true. Crusades are very expensive.
And Richard really was a great king when it came to the Crusades, but he spent a very short period of time of his rule actually in England. And he, because of his absence, it kind of sowed the seeds for all the discontent that happens after he dies.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, he was a kind of a glorious king,
mm-hmm.
but maybe not really a great one.
Not the best civic ruler, yeah.
Sean, tell us about Pandolf. Pandolf. The cardinal.
I think what I've enjoyed... No, I'll go back. I think when I started doing it, I thought I was going to be coming in with Pandolf from a very religious... from a very religious standpoint. And then the more we did the play and the more we played around with what different characters wanted, I realized that a legate of the Pope is there for just as much a political reason as everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting to go back to the history and discover what my boss was doing and what he wanted at the time and what Pope Innocent III was doing around Europe, and then to have that information come in and affect the scenes. And it was interesting for me to realize I'm just as much trying to find a valuable or the most valuable side for Rome to support as every character is in the play trying to figure out the best side for them to support. So I'm really excited, I think, to show a religious individual, maybe not so much in the religious light that people are expecting. Because I know that through the speeches he is very preachy and such, and maybe in his actions he can be very preachy, but ultimately he's there for political reasons just as much as anyone else.
He plays the religion card.
He definitely plays the religion card.
This is the play of politicians.
Oh, yeah. It's all about power.
Like, I think every, even, you know, Constantine, Pandolf, everyone is, even Ryan if they're not a ruler, is some form of politician.
And I think every character at this table at one point plays the religion card, as Tom just put it.
Yeah. Like,
everybody says, you know, God gave me the right to do this. God gave me the right to be king. God gave me the right to go on campaign or whatever it is.
What I do really enjoy most of all, I think, is how Pandolf kind of seems to get what he wants at the end of every scene that he's in, apart from when he's met with Lewis. And Lewis doesn't do what he wants. That's a massive shock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, another really interesting turning point, mm-hmm. even though it's at the very end. Sort of.
Almost. It's our end.
Zach, where does the King of France fit into this?
So, that's a really good question. Because, this is one of the really kind of weird structural things. Like, the King of France has one role, and then he's towards the middle of the play completely supplanted by his son. Not that we see that there's any actual power struggle between the two of them in the play necessarily. We've sort of created one to help us out, and I think that's been a really good choice. But the King of France just kind of disappears and isn't seen in Acts 4 or 5. That wasn't the question I thought you were going to ask me. I thought you were going to ask me what I liked about the King of France, and I was prepared for that, so I can say that if you would.
Sure, what do you like about the King of France?
So the really cool thing about this part is that I personally have never played a king before, and this is a very... this king has a lot of very... I want to say flowery, but that has a pejorative term, so it's just a lot of beautiful language.
Heightened language,
yeah, absolutely, and it's been an absolute joy to push through the verse and actually get what I want and try to make the scenes move through the verse. And King John is one of the only two plays that are entirely written in verse that Shakespeare wrote.
Four.
Is there four?
There's four. I think there's a couple of them have like 99.9%.
And so it's just been really, it's been lovely and an experience to a certain extent. I mean, like some of the parts I've had have been very verse heavy, but this is the one that really, he really uses the verse and the rhetoric to get what he wants, as he should, being a very... high status, kingly kind of character.
I have to say, listening to you doing your speech, you know, to Pandolf, I get so lost in listening to what you're saying because it's so heightened
it's
and
very,
so lovely.
It's very lovely.
I often
yes.
miss my cue just. I'm so caught up in it.
It really is a beautiful speech.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
You talk party.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, Sean, you said that this is a play of politicians. Mm. So do you think that is something that is would be engaging to a modern audience? I mean, do you think that there are things in the play maybe that are more, you know, more timely now than they may have been 50, 100 years ago?
Yeah, I definitely think so. While I know that there are probably a lot of historical references that I don't think... people will, or maybe they will get. I mean, if some people
Stephen
prepared
Langton
to come and
fan club.
watch historical. But I think in, you know, if you look at today's politics, I mean, or any like community or business, at the end of the day, we do strive for what we would like to achieve. And I think there are a lot of characters that have points that can actually really hit home that I do think people can sympathize with, like Constance with her son. She's only doing the best for her child. You know, maybe Lewis trying to come out of his father's shadow. I mean, I don't know, but sometimes when I listen to Lewis, I kind of think, oh, that's someone who really wants to either do his father proud or wants to be seen as different to his father. So I think...
Yeah.
Whether or not it's political, there's definitely an element in everyone's characters that I think a modern audience can get on board with and say, I get it. I don't necessarily agree, but that's okay, because I get where that desire or motivation is coming from.
This is the this is the original Game of Thrones.
It is.
Yeah.
It really is.
I mean, that's what it is.
If you notice the postcard, God's reference.
Which was unintentional.
Was it?
It was completely
Oh, really?
Because I'd never seen Game of Thrones
oh.
at the time.
Well, it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
So, good job.
Our original design was like a really dramatic like chessboard. And uh-huh. I was like, I really like that, but chess maybe not be the... Especially for a play like this where nobody knows. Yeah. Might not be the most exciting mm-hmm. imagery. Yeah.
There's lots of battles, so like the swords are perfect. Yeah.
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 You don't see any of the battles.
Yeah.
But not on stage.
Sorry, not on stage.
A lot of sounds of battles off stage.
Yeah. There's just one fight, so
yes.
So I think we shouldn't give your character short shrift, Chris, because the bastard is one of the most interesting characters in the play.
In Shakespeare's canon, even. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he's ahistorical. I mean, he's loosely based on...
Isn't there like one line in some register somewhere that says...
It's like Philip of Cognac.
Yeah.
It's like the bastard son of Richard King the Lionheart. And that's probably where he got the name Philip. But I mean, I don't think there's any real historical analog for him. I mean, I think he's one of those characters that is Shakespeare has a, you know, has a habit of writing these characters that are almost like Shakespeare injecting his own. I mean, and this is something we ascribe nowadays, but it's like a voice that is outside of the play, commenting on the play.
Yeah,
and that's something Shakespeare does a lot with like Mercutio, with Richard III, mm-hmm. with Iago to some extent. You know, Benedick. Baroon, you know, these voices that are like are out that exist outside of the action and inside of the action at the same time.
What are you really excited to bring to the play as the bastard?
Just all these stuff that nobody's ever heard, like all those great speeches that nobody's heard. And it's a fun character, you know. It's a fun part.
I mean, it amazed me reading the play and especially seeing the rehearsals, just how much. For a play that nobody knows, just how much of it has actually penetrated our consciousness because the characters and the speeches are so freaking good. Mm-hmm. Like the phrase, you know, gilding the lily comes from Richard III, and bell, book, and candle, you know?
Cold comfort.
Yeah.
Puppy dogs.
Yeah, this play is the first recorded use of puppy dogs.
Is that right?
In the English language. Yeah. There you go. There's your fact.
I have a question for you. How many of you, honestly, when you got cast as King John, had not read King John yet?
I completely.
I'm going to confess.
Yeah.
I was interested in it because I was in the Reduced Shakespeare Company's Complete Works of Shakespeare Abridged, and they make a joke about King John being the least known Shakespeare play of all of his canon, and so I being cast in King John, I'd be like, I know King John now.
Yeah. I mean, that was part of the appeal for me. I mean, I think I said to you when we were first talking, when I was first cast, was like, it's the closest that we're ever going to get to doing a world premiere Shakespeare. As far as people in Baltimore, as Chris said, it hasn't been performed here since the 1780s. And so for most people, you know, I'm going to be the first King Philip of France they will ever see. And I find that really cool.
Yeah. Maybe the last.
For another 200 years.
And as an actor, too, you think it's like, this is a role that I will probably never get a chance to play again.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm not going to be finding everyone doing King John next year. You know, it's
I was such a good job that everybody's going to want to do.
I mean, that's true. That is true.
I mean, I'm just.
But we're going to have to be the same cast over and over.
So I'm just interested in reaction then, since I don't think anybody had. I think Chris had read it before.
I had read it.
And you'd read it.
Yeah.
But for those of you, what was your first impression when you, all right, I'm a cast, I'm not even sure who I am yet in this play, I'll take the role, yeah, whatever, you know, because Baltimore Shakespeare pays so much, so I'll take the role. you know, so what was your impression when you first read it?
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, me too.
I thought it was so funny, like, even just on the page, like, some of the stuff that the bastard says is, like, and hang a calfskin. He's just trolling poor Oster. It was funny right off the page, and I thought, I was like, okay, yeah, this is gonna be good.
Yeah, like I was reading it, I was laughing all the way through Act Two. Like when the heralds come on, and like the English herald speaks, and then the French herald speaks, I'm like, it's just, there's an absurdity about it. And like
section,
a soap opera quality, as we've all kind of talked before that is just so weirdly funny.
Yeah, reading Constance for the first time, I was like, she's just dripping disdain. It's like, this is a Jerry Springer episode. Awesome.
Yeah, I think Shakespeare had some disdain for the noble classes, and I think that comes through. And even though they were pretty much all the people he wrote about, I think there was some resentment.
I have an entire
and the
speech.
And the French.
And interestingly,
and the Welsh.
The French has an entire speech about how terrible nobility is, you know, so.
Yeah. So,
you know, when I was working my way through the canon for the first time, you know, I put the Timons and the King Johns at the end of my list. And I remember getting to King John and saying, okay, now I got to read King John. And I thought, Jesus Christ, how has this play never been done before? Not done more. This is a great play.
Yeah. And it's just really, I said it before, it's just really tight. You know, it's not as sprawling. Like some of the histories have an unfair reputation anyway, because they have king names and other numbers after them. It's like Henry VI Part 3?
Add in like the 30 dukes and...
Right. Yeah. But they're really good plays. They're funnier than some of the comedies, I think.
I have to say, from a really nerdy historical point of view, I was really excited to see this play, because whenever you read about Henry VIII breaking away from church with his wives and that malarkey, I would always read histories that would reference the fact that King John tried to do it first. And so I was so interested to see that, you know, putting this play on its feet... There's one thing to read it, it's another thing entirely to see it brought to life. And I was really excited to see what the character of King John and how he dealt with it and everything that... Because even though it's not touched on very much, I don't think, the fact that it was still happening and King John was part of this whole fiasco, I was really excited to see how it was dealt with in this play once it was on its feet.
Well, and I love that speech King John has where, you know... He just tells off the Pope. It's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, I just love that. He's just really sticking it to the Catholic Church. And I've got to believe that at the time that would have been first performed at Shakespeare's, it wouldn't have been the Globe.
Oh, scandalous, I'm sure. Yeah.
Would have. No, I wouldn't even say scandalous, because I would say his audience had to love that.
They were pretty anti-Catholic.
Queen Elizabeth probably loved it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but no, it is weird just how similar this play actually it resembles events that were, you know, very near to the Elizabethans, you know, Armadas being sunken in the ocean and breaking with the Catholic Church and taking money from the monasteries and the abbeys and the break from the church. It is very contemporary to an Elizabethan audience too.
Yeah,
because it's late in Elizabeth's reign, and Elizabeth, when she first became the queen, had pretty much a "don't ask, don't tell" policy about whether or not you were Catholic. But when the Pope put out a papal bull, basically saying, "If somebody kills Elizabeth, we're willing to kind of look the other way and still get it passed to heaven," Elizabeth came really, really strict with Catholics. So I think that would have resonated with an audience in the pit, you know, where that John's speech about, you know, this ridiculous.
Where we do reign, we will alone uphold.
Yeah.
Without the assistance of a mortal hand. That's a boom, mic drop.
I'm sure the queen was very happy with
that. Yeah.
we're wrapping up here. I'm transitioning into the wrap up phase.
God for editing.
Good transition. Yeah.
You're going to edit that out, right?
No, I'm not. No, lazy.
Great segue there, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are the takeaways? What are the last thoughts you want to leave somebody with? If they're on the fence.
I mean, just that these characters are just so much fun to watch and to play, but for an audience, it'll be fun to watch. And again, it's stuff that you wouldn't expect to see in a play that is so rarely performed. You wouldn't expect it to be this much fun to watch, but it really is. You know, this is not your father's Shakespeare.
What do you think, Sean?
Oh boy.
Or here's an alternate question. You can say what is something you've gotten out of the process? Have you gotten anything out of doing this play? That is unique to this play.
I'm actually going to go with what Zach was on the thread. Zach was going for. I think when you come and watch this play, maybe come without a sense of it's going to be historical and therefore boring and long and they're just going to have facts thrown at me that I can't process. I think what I've learned from doing this is ultimately it is just people vying for something that they want, whether or not they're a king or a cardinal or an heir. It's people vying for what they want, and I think that's really interesting to see how they go about and get it, because that happens all the time. So I think if you come to the play and think, I'm gonna watch a saga unfold that constantly changes depending on turning, you know, different turning points that get thrown in, you're ultimately watching people battle it out on stage with very heightened language and some jokes thrown in and some very strong female characters, which I think is fabulous.
And I mean, I think the takeaway when you're coming to the show is it's personal, like Sean was saying, but the stakes are so high, and I think there will be moments where it's like, you know, everything is hinging on a single moment, and people are going to be like, and like at the edge of their seat.
He threw his fists up.
Yeah. And I was inching towards the edge of my chair, and I think, you know, if you're coming in, you're thinking, oh, well, it's a history play, I think you're going to be surprised by how enthralled you are to it.
Yeah, thinking back of that, I think it feels like the least like history play format of all of Shakespeare's history plays that I've ever read. It's very kind of oddly tragedy and comedy at the same time. And I think if you're thinking of coming to see the show, this is a show you will never get to see probably again unless you specifically go search it out. And I know I love on stage watching people do this script. So I think it's a show you can't miss.
Yeah. All of these characters are larger than life and this cast is so talented and we're just having fun with it. And we invite you, dear viewers, listeners and viewers to come and join us.
Tom, last thoughts?
Well, one of our goals at Baltimore Shakespeare Factory is to do the complete canon of Shakespeare, and we're about halfway through now. And so if that's a goal that you have, to see the complete canon, we're getting ready to do some plays that most people don't do. You know, on our horizon, we have the three Henry the Sixes. And so this would be the first kind of peg in your board on that one. You know, if you miss this one, it might be hard for you to get the whole canon, or you'll have to do, like you said, you know, search it out.
Yeah.
To find it. So, you know what? And I like what Zach said also, the idea that, you know what, this is like a Shakespeare premiere for you to see.
Yeah,
it is, really, kind of.
You know, and the beauty of it, too, we talk about this in rehearsal all the time. The idea that when you go to see Midsummer Night's Dream or Romeo and Juliet or the other common plays that Shakespeare's written, everybody knows how they're going to end. Come to this one because you don't know how it's going to end.
Yep.
You don't know what's happening next. So I think it will be more suspenseful for you in that way. So come out and see it. We think you'll have fun.
Yeah, and on that note, we open, the 27th of July and run through August. So check our website and
four straight weekends.
Yep, our social media.
And then we're doing Bordy Vineyards, too.
We have two shows at Bordy, all that information is online. So, King John, ladies and gentlemen, this might be your only chance to see it, and it's criminally underperformed. This is a really great play, you know, and I don't think we'll be as enthusiastic maybe when we get to the Timon's, but that has its merits too.
Timon is a really good play to see on stage. It's not a great read.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we won't talk about that. We'll talk about that in a couple years when we do that.
What is that? That's not what we're doing. We're doing King John.
We're doing King John.
Coming to see Timon.
King John is great.
Coming to see King John.
We said that we're doing King John.
What's the name? King John. King John.
So we'll see you at King John. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.